on a cultural crusade all across America. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, where there's a great slogan out there, which many Americans believe holds the key to world harmony. The slogan, Land for Peace. As applied to the Middle East, that slogan raises the question, why won't Israel give back some of the territory that it conquered in 1967 in return for Arab recognition and promises of peace? Well, you know what? Israel tried to do just that, not yesterday, not the day before yesterday, but more than 30 years ago. And the fact that it didn't work out as well as you might expect is part of our special broadcast today, Five Middle Eastern Wars. A special broadcast on the Michael Medved Show to give you the perspective you need to understand the current issues that involve America, whether we like it or not, issues involving war and peace in the Middle East. Israel wins a sweeping victory in the 1967 June War, the Six-Day War, a victory that hugely enlarges the Israeli land area, adding the Sinai and the West Bank and East Jerusalem and the Golan Heights. But no one in Israel expected that all of those territorial gains would be permanent. In fact, Walter Eitan, who was the first director general of the Israeli Foreign Office, wrote in 1973, it was widely assumed, even by members of the Israel government, he wrote, that this third round of fighting after 1948 and 1956 must be the last, and that peace could be around the corner. It was taken for granted that in this event, at least the bulk of the territories, which had been Egypt's, Syria's, and Jordan's, would be evacuated and restored to those countries. Unquote. In fact, within weeks of Israel's victory in June of 1967, the Israeli government was trying to communicate to Syria and to Egypt through the Americans its willingness to pull out, except for a minor adjustment of borders, entirely from the West Bank. Minor adjustments of borders for the sake of security. But the response of the Arab states came very decisively in an Arab summit conference in Khartoum, Sudan, in August of 1967, just weeks after the end of the war. And the Arab crowds that gathered in riots and demonstrations all around the Arab world were thrilled with the results of that Khartoum conference. Why? Because it offered the famous three no's of Khartoum. No peace, no recognition, no negotiations. In fact, rather than negotiating with the Israelis, President Nasser of Egypt had another approach. Right after the June war, he had resigned, given the fact that the war was such an unmitigated disaster for his country. But of course, being a total autocrat, a complete one-man show, a dictator, there's really nobody to accept your resignation. And the people of Egypt demanded that he stay on. And in fact, he responded to the Israeli offers of peace by sinking an Israeli destroyer in October 21st, 1967, the destroyer Eilat, killing 47 Israelis. Even though the destroyer was well outside of Egyptian territorial waters, that helped to begin what is called the War of Attrition. Now, the War of Attrition doesn't sound like much, and almost everyone has forgotten about it, but for 3 years, there was almost constant shelling back and forth across the Suez Canal. The Egyptians shelling and attacking the Israelis, aerial battles, battles of every sort. In fact, 1,424 Israeli soldiers and more than 100 civilians died in this war of attrition. When President Nasser died and was mourned fanatically in one of the largest funerals ever staged for anybody, a funeral that drew a reported 2 million Egyptian mourners, he was succeeded by a more practical sort. Anwar al-Sadat, another Egyptian army officer. And Sadat did suggest and communicated to the Israelis through the Americans that he might be ready to make peace with Israel if Israel immediately returned every scrap of territory that Israel had occupied. But of course, the Israelis were not about to give back East Jerusalem, not when for the first time there was equal access for Jews and entirely equal access for Christians and Muslims to all holy sites in Jerusalem. Jews had been strictly banned from going to East Jerusalem and the Old City and the holy sites there during the Jordanian rule. And there was also a desire on the part of many Israelis to begin building some settlements to provide for Israeli security, particularly along the Jordan Valley. Outposts, think Fort Apache, that could help to protect Israel in the case, as many Israelis believe to be inevitable, that they returned most of the land to the Arabs in return for peace. In any event, an immediate return to Sadat was not on, and Sadat indicated that if Israel didn't give in to his terms, he was willing to see the sacrifice, he said, of 1 million dead Egyptian soldiers for the sake of liberating the Sinai. Now, with all of this talk and all of this struggle, there is a big question about the very successful Egyptian and Syrian surprise attack against Israel in October of 1973, just a little bit more than 6 years after the June War. Why were the Israelis caught by surprise? In fact, there was a whole commission in Israel, the Agranat Commission, that asked the same question. You can't mass 80,000 people and have them cross the Suez Canal and attack Israel proper without giving some indication that the attack is on the way. Well, the truth of the matter is that the Israelis had all kinds of indications that the attack was coming. They were overconfident. They had more faith than they should have in their fixed bunkers along the Suez Canal. They had more confidence than they should have in their air force, not recognizing that the tremendous arming of the Egyptians and particularly the Syrians by the Soviets had changed the military balance. One of the things that had worked very well for the North Vietnamese in Vietnam was SAMs, surface-to-air missiles. They got very good at shooting down some American jets. And that same kind of equipment was provided by the Russians to their Arab allies. As a matter of fact, during this period between the two wars, 67 and 73, the Soviets poured more money, more weapons into the Middle East than they ever had before, leading the Americans to provide more weapons for Israel than America ever had before. There was certainly more sophisticated armaments on both sides. But part of the insistence of Moshe Dayan, the Israeli defense minister, for not striking first, as had been done in 1967, was, as he said in cabinet meetings and as he said to the chief of staff, Dovid Elazar, he said very clearly, this time we want it to be unmistakable that we didn't start the war, the Arabs started the war. Dayan cared, as did the Israeli Prime Minister, Golda Meir, very passionately what the Americans thought. There was the feeling that Israel couldn't be isolated. We needed world opinion. Israel needed world opinion, so they argued. And therefore, it's better to absorb an attack than to preempt it. This strange sort of approach, this odd thinking, reached such an extreme that in the beginning of October of 1973, when there are very clear indications that the Egyptians and the Syrians were getting ready to strike Israel, the chief of staff, Dovid Elazar, got almost hysterical, saying, we need to mobilize. If you don't let us strike first, at least we have to mobilize all our reserves, because Israel has a very small standing army and very large reserves. Dayan said no. If we mobilize, that will look provocative, then they will blame us for starting the war. People will say, we're planning the war. We'll have time. We'll be able to mobilize the reserves. And Elazar was furious. He said, we must mobilize. I want to mobilize 150,000 men. Dayan said, no, you can mobilize 50,000. 150,000 we don't need. They went to the prime minister, Prime Minister Golda Meir. She's listening to these two brilliant younger men arguing back and forth about how many people to mobilize, and she did a very Jewish thing. She split the difference. She said, okay, he says 150,000 men, you say 50,000 men, you can mobilize 100,000 men. That was the order for the chief of staff, General Elazar. Fortunately, he completely ignored the order. He went ahead and mobilized the 150,000 men that he felt would be needed. And it was barely enough. Yom Kippur Day, the holiest day of the Jewish year, the entire power structure, everybody, even in a non-religious country, tends to go to services to observe the Day of Atonement. That was the day at 2 in the afternoon that President Sadat of Egypt planned for striking against Israel. So we continue with 5 Middle Eastern wars. A special broadcast, 5 Middle Eastern wars, on the background to the current Israeli-Arab conflict. In October 1973, on a quiet Yom Kippur morning with most of Israel at prayer, the Arabs struck in a brilliantly conceived and extraordinarily well-executed military maneuver, both from Egypt and from Syria. And this represented at least a strategic short-term triumph that later allowed Anwar Sadat, who had helped to conceive it and execute it, to have the kind of dignity that he needed to be the first Arab leader to make peace with Israel. In any event, the strike was not peaceful at all when it occurred on Yom Kippur Day. It was, in fact, brutal. It arrived with 240 Egyptian warplanes flying over the Suez Canal, and some 80,000 Egyptians pouring over the canal and into the Sinai Peninsula that was still being held by Israel, and overwhelming some of the 16 isolated Israeli forts along the Barlev line on the eastern side of the canal. The odds were not promising. 436 Israelis were there, most of them reservists, most of them amateurs, were there in the forts facing tens of thousands, ultimately 80,000 Egyptians. There was also about the same sort of odds on the northern front, where the Syrians were able to muster some 1,800 attack tanks against less than 200 Israeli tanks facing them. And the Arab armies made dramatic progress in the opening stages of the war, partially because the SAMs, the surface-to-air missiles, made it very difficult for Israel to use its air force in the way that it had done in 1967. In fact, the losses of the Israeli Air Force were devastating. Nearly a third of its planes shot down at one engagement or another, largely by these surface-to-air missiles and the anti-aircraft fire that the Arabs were able to muster. The dramatic events involved these Israeli forts, so isolated, and as Martin Gilbert, historian of Israel, writes, the names of the defenders of these forts have become legendary in Israel. Among them, Corporal Orlev, Lieutenant Shlomo Ardanest, and Captain Moti Ashkenazi. Because these handful of people, commanding in some cases just dozens, were able to hold out for necessary hours while the mobilization orders went out across Israel and the hundreds of thousands of reservists came to the front. One of the things that people have observed is it's an irony that the Arabs chose to attack on Yom Kippur, because the one advantage that attacking on that day gave to the Israelis is everybody was concentrated basically in synagogue at prayer. So it was easier than it would have been to get the word to people about where to go and to leave immediately. And of course, even the most orthodox of rabbis acknowledge that Yom Kippur and the restrictions on travel and communication have to fall away in case of dire national emergency. There's one story that's told by Chaim Herzog, who's a historian of all of Israel's wars and a leading Israeli politician, that was told to him by an Egyptian general after the war. And that Egyptian general talked about a lone Israeli tank that fought off the attacking forces for over half an hour, causing very heavy casualties to my men when they tried to storm it. When they finally overcame it, the Egyptian general recounted how, to his utter amazement, he found that all of the crew inside the tank had been killed, with the exception of one wounded soldier who had continued to fight. The Egyptian general described how impressed he and his men were by this man, who was, as he was being carried away on a stretcher to a waiting ambulance, saluted the Egyptian general. With Israeli mobilization, the tide began to turn. And one of the decisive elements to be mobilized was the most controversial general in Israeli history. His name was Ariel Sharon. He's described much, much earlier after the Suez campaign, nearly 20 years earlier, in 1956. He was described by Chaim Herzog as a very independently minded and assertive character. He can best be described as a Patton-like, swashbuckling general who rose in the ranks of the Israel Defense Forces, proved himself to have an uncanny feel for battle, but at the same time to be a most difficult person to command. Few of any of his superior officers over the years had a good word to say about him, as far as human relations and integrity were concerned, although none would deny his innate ability as a field soldier. Probably because of this, he never achieved his great ambition to be chief of staff of the armed forces. In fact, he had left the army, had gone into politics, had organized the new Likud party. The conservative party in Israel today was actually founded by Ariel Sharon before the October War of 1973. But with the battle raging, he couldn't stay out of the battle. He came back into the army and took over part of the Southern Command. And he had a daring scheme, which he fought for relentlessly. And finally, his superiors in the government allowed him to put it forward. The scheme was that the Egyptians had crossed over going from west to east into the Israeli section of the Sinai, the section that the Israelis had controlled. They crossed the Suez Canal. What Sharon said is as the Israelis were throwing thousands of men trying to counterattack to drive the Egyptians back across the canal, so let's go in behind them. Let's go below them, cross over the canal in the other direction, and head toward Cairo. And we will have the Egyptians in the Sinai surrounded. He was initially turned down. He fought. His nickname, after all, is Bulldozer. And Ariel Sharon emerged as the great hero of the 1973 October War, the Yom Kippur War, because he insisted on this approach and ended up getting his men across the canal, coming up behind the Egyptian Third Army, with, again, nothing between him and Cairo, really. The war, which had begun very badly for the Israelis, ended up as a great triumph. They took more territory in Syria and the Golan Heights. They took territory now for the first time on the west side of the Suez Canal. The problem was that all of that was possible only because of American resupply. They had lost so many tanks, so many planes in the early going of the war, and the Russians were so active in pouring weapons into the Arab side, the Syrian and Egyptian side, that President Nixon, who was embroiled in the Watergate mess at the time, determined belatedly toward the end of the war to resupply Israel. What was horrifying was that none of our so-called allies, America's so-called allies, France or England, allowed overflight or cooperated in the resupply. America had to use Portugal, a dictatorship, and land in the Azores to send the big transport planes over with the resupply that Israel needed. But the U.S. cooperation was very significant. It drove home to the Israelis more than ever before how dependent they had become on the United States, and they were to become more dependent than ever before when Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State, forced General Ariel Sharon and the Israelis to pull back and avoid a slaughter of the Egyptian Third Army in the interest and the hope of making peace. Did that succeed? Well, you could say in a short-term way, perhaps, in a limited way, certainly, but in a long-term way, it did not end the wars of the Middle East, the subject of this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show. Michael Medved Show, a special broadcast. We're talking now about the fourth of five Middle Eastern wars under discussion. In this case, the October War of 1973, the Yom Kippur War. Yom Kippur is the Day of Atonement in Jewish tradition. This became known to many as the War of Atonement, atonement for Israeli overconfidence. There were 2,688 Israeli soldiers who gave their lives in this struggle. That represents many times, some four times, the number of Israelis, nearly, who died in the Six-Day War just some 6 years before. And there was a feeling that the war, while it was absolutely necessary, Israel had been attacked after all, that was very clear, had resolved absolutely nothing. And that's particularly true because Henry Kissinger, the American Secretary of State, working with President Nixon, used his clout with Israel, which was considerable because the American resupply in the midst of the October War had been so crucial to Israel's survival. Kissinger used his clout to have the Israelis stand down and to avoid massacring some thousands of Egyptian soldiers who were very available for massacre in the Sinai. They were surrounded. Behind them, they had the Israelis on the west side of the Suez Canal, and then massed Israeli forces in front of them on the Sinai. Kissinger saw an opportunity for peace, and he believed firmly, and he probably was right, that by allowing the Egyptians to end the war with less than a total crushing defeat, that might create the possibility for negotiations. And it was actually the Egyptian president himself, the hero of the crossing, as he became known in the Arab world after the October War, which was certainly the closest thing to an Arab victory in any of the Israeli-Arab wars. The hero of the crossing, Sadat, was able to change the world by his trip to Jerusalem in November 1977. And you can look at some of the tape, some of the film of that visit, and it's still thrilling, it's still inspiring to see it, to see this old warrior sitting down at a banquet between Menachem Begin, the then Israeli prime minister, and his old adversary Moshe Dayan, smiling and talking. I mean, the idea of peace when Anwar Sadat, the Egyptian president, actually spoke to the Israeli Knesset seemed all too real and tantalizingly real. And so after very, very difficult negotiations, which President Carter helped to conduct at Camp David, there was an agreement that Israel would give back to Egypt all of the territory which Israel had seized, all of the territory except for Gaza, which was part of what had been seized during the Six-Day War in 1967, not the October War. And Gaza, home to soon to be 1 million Palestinian refugees who got more and more numerous in Gaza, was simply something that Sadat did not want to take back as part of Egypt because it was supposed to be part of some future Palestinian state. And in any event, the idea of having 1 million Gazans incorporated in Egypt wasn't appealing to Sadat. The point about the Camp David Accords, which were negotiated, is that they held. They were put into practice. Part of what Israel had to do was to dismantle some settlements that it had built in Sinai, particularly a very large settlement of several thousand people called Yamit. And ironically, it was General Ariel Sharon, the Israeli hero of the October War, who actually was assigned to use the military force to take the unwilling Israeli settlers out of the Sinai to give the territory back to Egypt. No matter how one felt about the Camp David Accords, and Sharon, for one, opposed them at the time, the fact that there has been no major war involving Egypt was a tremendous tribute to Henry Kissinger, to Menachem Begin, to Anwar Sadat, and the people who negotiated this agreement. But it didn't mean that there was peace, because there was still open conflict on the border with Syria, and most of all, conflict with the Palestinians. Because with the removal of the biggest Arab nation from the war coalition against Israel, a great deal of the focus came from the Palestinians. The Palestinian radicals had been driven out of Jordan by King Hussein way back in 1970. They had established a new base of operations in Lebanon called Fatah Land after their organization Al-Fatah. And they use that base of operations for terrorist attacks all around the world. In 1982, in the midst of a terrible civil war in Lebanon, an Israeli defense minister named Ariel Sharon decided to do something about it with mixed results. I'll tell you about it coming up.
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. As the nation struggles with our legacy of racism and inequality, Many well-intentioned Americans embrace lies about white privilege, the idea that people of European ancestry enjoy vast advantages based solely on their ongoing oppression of all people of color. But many measures of well-being contradict this simplistic theory. Most recent numbers show white life expectancy declining, while Asian American people can expect to live a full 8 years longer, and Latino children will live on average 4 years longer than whites. Suicide in America claims twice as many lives as murder, and white people have the highest suicide rates, almost double those of black people. The largest number of crime victims, welfare recipients, drug deaths, and most other measures of misery are white. This doesn't mean black families don't suffer from intolerable race-based inequalities that must be overcome, but it's no solution to focus on purported white privilege that actually doesn't exist. I'm Michael Medved.
On this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, Five Middle Eastern Wars, we're looking at the 1980s, when, after making peace with Egypt, the biggest threat to Israel's survival came from the northern border, where there was almost constant shelling of some of Israel's northern communities, where there was a tremendous terrorist presence that had been established in Lebanon. The reason it was in Lebanon is because the Palestine Liberation Organization had been driven out, with some people estimate 10,000 casualties, by Jordan's King Hussein, from where it had been established in Jordan, had been driven into Lebanon and established what really was very similar to the Al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan, worldwide terrorist camps drawing between 15 and 18,000 people, including at least 5,000 foreign mercenaries from as far away as India and Pakistan and Mozambique, who came to this terror complex, Terror Central, and organized attacks on American and Israeli interests all around the world. Ariel Sharon, the tough Israeli Patton who had been the big hero of the October War, was serving as defense minister, and he organized an attack on Lebanon in 1982. Part of the reason that this made sense, at least in his viewpoint, was that up till that time, Lebanon, which at one point had been the most open, the most varied of all Arab nations, the one Arab nation with a substantial Christian presence, the Christian group in Lebanon had been traditionally a majority. Well, that had been somewhat overwhelmed by the Palestinians. A Lebanese civil war had been going on, and before the Israelis ever attacked in 1982, a minimum of 95,000 Lebanese had been killed and a minimum of 300,000 wounded in the terribly bloody Lebanese civil war. The Israelis invaded initially with the cooperation and support of much of the Lebanese Christian community in 1982, deliberately to get rid of Fatahland, this Palestinian enclave, this terror central that had been established in the country on Israel's northern border. And militarily, the invasion went well. It went surprisingly well. There had been estimates that the Israelis would face far more casualties than they did. The Syrians got involved, tried to deploy their air force. The Syrians lost close to 100 planes. The Israelis lost none. All of this went very well indeed, despite the fact that much of the world screamed and hollered and shouted. Eventually, the result of Sharon's war, as it became known, was to expel the Palestinians from Lebanon, to send Yasser Arafat packing. He went over to Tunisia in North Africa, far away, and to greatly reduce the level of attack against Israel from the north and the level of terror generally. But there was a cost. Wars of the Middle East, the subject of this special broadcast.
Thanks for listening to the Michael Medved Show. If you want more from your cultural crusader, check out Michael Medved's Substack at michaelmedved.substack.com. That's michaelmedved.substack.com in this greatest nation on God's green earth. This is the Michael Medved Show.
A special broadcast, Five Middle Eastern Wars, eventually the result of Sharon's war, as it became known, was to expel the Palestinians from Lebanon, to send Yasser Arafat packing. He went over to Tunisia in North Africa, far away, and to greatly reduce the level of attack against Israel from the north and the level of terror generally. But there was a cost. And the cost was a definite black eye in terms of public relations for the rest of the world. Many Israelis were minded to say, so what? But also a permanent Israeli presence in the southern tier of Lebanon to try to protect that northern border, a presence that was only eliminated some 20 years later by Ehud Barak, the very dovish prime minister of Israel, the same man who offered Yasser Arafat almost everything that he wanted in the Camp David negotiations. His withdrawal from Lebanon in the face of constant attacks by Hezbollah and other radical groups may have encouraged the Palestinians to think that they could weaken Israel with a new intifada. But that is another story. One of the dark moments for Israel involved the very end of the Lebanon campaign, where the Israelis were sweeping into Beirut, and they turned to their phalangist allies, their militant Christian Arab allies, to clean up one of the centers of Palestinian terrorism, two refugee camps. They were actually big cities with buildings as tall as 12 stories high, called Sabra and Shatila. And Ariel Sharon authorized the phalangists, these Christian militiamen, to go into these refugee camps. No Israeli troops went in at all, and to try to clean out the gunmen who were remaining there. What he should have realized was that the rage on the part of these Christian Arabs was very intense, because their leader, Bashir Gemayel, who had just been elected president of Lebanon, had been blown up in a car bomb, along with 25 of his followers and colleagues. And this rage resulted in a massacre. Now, how large was the massacre? Original Lebanese numbers say 400 people died, 35 of them women and children. Some other estimates by the press and others say that as many as 2,400 people died. In any event, it is ironic that it was a massacre of Muslim Arabs by Christian Arabs, for which Jews were blamed. Ariel Sharon was later blamed by the Kahan Commission, an independent Israeli commission. He was held to be, quote, indirectly responsible, because he should have known, he should have never allowed the Christian militiamen to go into those refugee camps. But the idea that he had something to gain, that he deliberately staged this massacre of Arabs, of Palestinians, is simply not true and not sustainable. Negligent, perhaps. Almost certainly. But guilty of this kind of a bloody slaughter? No. There's another charge that also rattles around, and it's still heard from time to time. People call my radio show about it concerning Israel. And that is about not massacring Arabs, but massacring Americans. In 1967, in the midst of the Six-Day War, an American spy ship was attacked by the Israeli Air Force and by the Israeli Navy. The spy ship Liberty was severely damaged, with 31 American sailors killed. The Israelis immediately apologized. They ended up paying some $13 million in payments to the families of the dead sailors. The Liberty was just off the coast of Israel at a time when Israelis had reported there was shelling, they thought, by an Egyptian ship. There was actually an ammunition dump that had blown up. The question about the Liberty really is, if the Israelis wanted to sink the ship, why didn't they? As soon as they recognized that it was an American ship, they stopped torpedoing it and they began rescuing the survivors. The other question is, after 10 different investigations by American and Israeli investigators, what possibly could have been gained by the Israelis trying to attack an American ship in the middle of a war that they were winning anyway, and where they had virtually nothing to hide from an American spy operation? The Liberty charge, the charge that there's some kind of conspiracy on the part of Israel to slaughter Americans, makes even less sense than the charge that there was some kind of conspiracy on the part of the Israelis to slaughter the people within the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. Meanwhile, a perspective on five Middle Eastern wars coming up.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
The celebrated director Alexander Payne, who previously crafted The Descendants and Sideways, works again with Paul Giamatti, who this time plays a crusty prep school teacher in 1970 who is stuck over Christmas holiday babysitting a small group of outcast students who deeply despise him in The Holdovers, now playing in theaters.
Now, most of the kids dislike you, pretty much hate you. Teachers, too. You know that, right?
I find the world a bitter and complicated place, and it seems to feel the same way about me.
And this is also a bitter and complicated movie with many touching elements and moments of unexpected humor. The supporting roles with young Dominic Sessa and Divine Joy Randolph are outstanding and impressive and likely to generate Oscar attention. At the end of 2 hours running time, you not only feel as if you know these people, but you actually come to care about them deeply. 3.5 stars for the impressive and unforgettable The Holdovers.
Special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, 5 Middle Eastern Wars, the War of Israeli Independence, 1948-49, the Suez Campaign of 1956, the Six-Day War, the June War of 1967, the October War, the Yom Kippur War of 1973, and the Lebanon Campaign of 1982. If you want this full broadcast on tape, you can get it through Tree Farm Communications at 800-468-0464. They also have available our other broadcast on why they fight, the origins of the Arab-Israeli conflict, a longer-term look at the resettlement of the ancient Jewish homeland in Israel and the Zionist movement. What about America's role? As you probably have learned from this broadcast, America did not begin as the sponsor, the creator of Israel. That is a lie, just like Nasser's big lie that there were American planes involved in destroying his air force. The truth of the matter is that America unwillingly and reluctantly got involved clearly on the Israeli side, which it has been since the War of 1973. It got involved in part because the Russians, our great rivals in the Cold War, were so clearly involved in the Arab side. And then again, there is the more recent Arab involvement in support of worldwide terrorism. None of this has its origins with Israel. The struggle between Islam and the West goes much further back. And the struggle with terror goes further back than many people remember. On July 4th, 1976, while America was celebrating its 200th anniversary, there were 105 Israeli and Jewish hostages being held in Entebbe in Uganda. They were freed ultimately in a daring raid led by the brother Yoni Netanyahu of the future Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, and that Yoni, of course, died in the raid. Bayard Rustin, the great American civil rights leader, African-American civil rights leader, said, "I am certain that for years and years to come, perhaps even 1,000 years from now, when people are confused and frightened, and they are dispossessed of their humanity and feel there is no way to go except to face death and destruction, someone will remember the story of Yoni at Entebbe. That story will be told to those despairing people, and someone will move into a corner and begin to whisper, and that will be the beginning of their liberation." Concerning that comment, Bill Bennett writes very movingly, "There in a kernel lies the meaning of Israel for us. I myself am one of tens of millions of Americans who have seen in the founding and flourishing of the Jewish state the hand of the same beneficent God who attended our own founding and has guided our fortunes until now. Keeping faith with the people of Israel in their still unfinished confrontation with evil is to me a species of keeping faith with ourselves. Breaking faith, a species of self-negation. It is exactly that simple," writes Bill Bennett, "and exactly that difficult, and exactly that consequential." The wars of the Middle East, deeply consequential, not only to the citizens of that region, but to the greatest nation on God's green earth, upward and onward.
Thanks for listening to the Michael Medved Show. If you want more from your cultural crusader, check out Michael Medved's Substack at michaelmedved.substack.com. That's michaelmedved.substack.com. There you'll find conversations with columnists and newsmakers, movie reviews, archives, and a lot more content exclusive to Substack. Check it out today in this greatest nation on God's green earth. This is the Michael Medved Show.